Okay, we're going to start where we finished last time, or last night. And we're on number 14 of the twos. Next we have patience and gentleness. Patience is one of the highest virtues in Buddhism. The Buddha said that if you have patience, you can attain Nibbana. And it's hard to be patient when you're meditating. It's hard to be patient when there's pain arising, and you have to be patient with it and not try to control it. The whole essence of the Buddha's teaching is about opening and relaxing and allowing everything to be there as it is. Seeing everything as an impersonal process. And without that sense of patience, then that little self comes in and says, I want to control this. I want to make it different than it is. I don't like this situation the way it is. And then there's force. Anytime you have force, or a want to control, then your mind is very tight and tense. And the essence of the Buddha's teaching is openness and calmness. So it's quite a bit different. So that's why the Buddha said anyone that has that can be patient, they're close to Nibbana. And the whole thing about gentleness, too many times people, when they're meditating, try to force. They try to make things happen instead of just observe. And this force is a kind of tightness. And there's always that ego identification of wanting things to be this way, so you put a little bit of extra energy into it. Anytime you put a little bit extra energy into anything to try to make it be the way you want it to be, it causes restlessness to arise. And restlessness is one of the big hindrances that really causes a lot of problems. The more you can let go and relax and gently watch what's happening, the more you can open up and just say, okay, that's it, and that's happening right now, and let it be. With emotions, with desires, just gently allow them to be without acting on them or reacting, as the case may be. It's always gently allow. Now, I talked last night about some of the people that came from my last meditation class. This one lady had been practicing Vipassana for a long time. So she came in, one, with the attitude of, I know what I'm doing. And then when I started talking to her about opening and relaxing, she didn't understand it. And I told her about focusing her mind on loving kindness and that good feeling. After a half an hour, she was so restless that she was about ready to jump out of her skin. And I said, how was the meditation? And she said, it was horrible. I said, why? She said, I couldn't make that feeling stay. It always went away. I spent all my time trying to bring this feeling up again. I said, you're trying too hard, aren't you? This is a gentle kind of meditation. It's not forceful meditation. It's a being happy meditation. Even when you're in hell, you're smiling. You're gentle. You're not trying to control. And that's what she was doing. She was trying to control. So these two aspects of the Buddha's teachings they're like main pillars. And they're real simple little words. Be patient. Be gentle. I know some people that do meditation and they don't get the result they want, so they try harder. And the harder they try, the worse the meditation becomes. The more active their mind becomes. Instead of peaceful and calm, they wind up tightening. Well, this isn't right. I'll try harder again. This has to be open, relaxing, calm, very, very gentle, a light touch. Now, yesterday I talked a little bit about joy. When you have joy in your mind is very light, and it's very agile, and it can touch things and see things very clearly, very quickly, when there's joy. So this is an aspect of gentleness, and it's very much necessary. When you're in your daily life, the more you can cultivate joy, the more clear your mind becomes, the more uplifted your mind becomes. Then you don't have these heavy emotional states pulling you down. Now, the last time I was here, I was talking a lot about smiling. Why? You have to have a sense of humor with your spiritual practice. And I'll read some from this book in a minute. The lighter your mind becomes, the clearer you are, and the less you are attached. Joy is absolutely necessary for the spiritual path. And I do know that a lot of Vipassana teachers, they try to scare people away from having joy. And a lot of people that practice Vipassana meditation are the most somber, critical-minded people I've ever run across. I know, I used to be one. Okay, another aspect is gentle speech and politeness. The kinder your speech is, the less gossip there is in it, the less heaviness, the more people listen to you. So you want to use good speech. You don't want to use coarse speech. And the more polite you are with other people, the more willing they are to listen to you. Now, one of the aspects of being a teacher is that the teacher has to give a lot of encouragement, especially in meditation, but it doesn't matter what brand of teaching it is, whether you're teaching school or teaching somebody how to do something. When you start focusing on what a person does right, that's polite speech. And the more polite you are and the more you focus on what another person does right, the more confidence they have that they can do it. Anytime there's any criticalness, the other person closes down. And how does that criticalness manifest in you? That critical manifests in you as, I know it, and you don't know it, and I'm right. And that is the fastest way to make people go away. So the more polite you can be, the easier things become. Okay, the next is non-harming impurity. Non-harming. One of the favorite terms in the suttas is people get together and they start stabbing each other with verbal daggers. And that is a very harmful thing. People are more harmful with their tongue than they are with their actions. So non-harming means not causing harm in any way, as much as you possibly can. As you do this, your mind becomes more uplifted. With that uplifted mind, you start seeing things the way they truly are. And when you start seeing things the way they truly are, your mind becomes more open and light. And that's what a pure mind is all about. This is what meditation is all about, learning how to purify your mind. Emotional states, when they arise, cause your mind to be very heavy and hard. And a mind is pure is very light and happy. And it's not the kind of happiness that you turn into giddy kind of laughter. This is just a happiness of not having any heaviness. Now, you want to get into a creative mind. You can't do it when you're emotional. It doesn't work. The only time you can get into your creative mind is when there's happiness with what's happening right now. Even though it might be a difficult situation, you look at it as, okay, things have to change now. That's a pure mind. And that's what we're trying to develop with the meditation, especially when you're practicing loving-kindness meditation. You're developing this mind that's more and more clear all the time. You're letting go of all the emotional garbage. And you're letting go of that subtle ego identification with all the thoughts and all the feelings. That letting go of that tightness in your head or any tightness in your body and relaxing. And then bringing that mind back to your object of meditation is bringing a completely pure mind back to your meditation. One-pointed concentration has the tendency to make mind heavy because you have to contract. You have to pull everything in so you can focus very deeply on one thing. That causes tightness to arise. And that's the opposite of what the Buddha was talking about. The more you can open and allow, relax into everything that arises, the more pure your mind becomes. The more pure your mind becomes, the more creative you become with whatever you're doing. Okay, the next thing is the lack of mindfulness and clear awareness. In the Eightfold Path, there's one thing that one of the factors is right mindfulness. And people always naturally assume mindfulness is a positive thing because they see right mindfulness all the time. But mindfulness can be positive or negative. A person that's robbing a bank is very mindful. But the kind of mindfulness we're talking about here is the kind of mindfulness that goes much deeper. It's not the surface being afraid of being caught mindfulness. It's the observation and awareness of how mind is moving. Now, when you don't have mindfulness, you have a mind that is caught by emotional states. Now, yesterday I talked a little bit about dependent origination. And when there's contact, right after contact, there's feeling. Right after feeling, there's the like, I like it, I don't like it mind. Right after that, there's the thinking. When your mindfulness is sharp, as soon as a feeling arises, that's when you start opening and allowing, letting go. Okay? And when you do that, then there is no craving. There is no I like it, I don't like it. Everything is fine. It takes very, very sharp and clear observation to be able to see this. It's not easy. You remember last night I said that was a million thought moments. And I'm talking about seeing each one of them. One of the things that happens when you learn how to meditate is your awareness becomes much faster. So you start seeing things in much clearer ways. Now, an example, when you're sitting in meditation, you have a restless feeling come up. Okay, a restless feeling is a feeling like you want to jump out of your skin. You feel like you just can't stand being still. You need to get up and move. I have to go do this right now. But you see that as part of your mind's game. So what do? Eventually, you recognize that your mind is doing this, and you open up and let it be, and relax, and come back to your object of meditation. Now, you might be on your object of meditation for a split second before that restlessness comes up again. The true mindfulness is watching how things arise. Not why, not where they're going, but how. So, when you start becoming more aware with your meditation, you see your mind is restless, and you let it go and relax and come back to your object of meditation. And the next time that restlessness arises, you start to see there's a feeling first, and then a little tiny dislike. And then the feeling gets bigger, and the dislike gets bigger, and finally it just pulls you away. How does that process work? When you become familiar with how the process works, you start recognizing it more quickly. Now, you're doing this while you're sitting in meditation, but what happens when you get restless out here? You do the same thing. you start recognizing these hindrances and how your mind closes down around them and tries to control. And that want to control causes it to be bigger and more intense, and the lack of patience becomes very strong. So what we do is see how the process works while you're sitting with your alone time. And you can see it very, very well after a period of time. When you're out in your daily life, your mind is not going to be as deeply centered or still. But you still use the same practice. Now, this is one of the major differences between one-pointed concentration and true mindfulness and clear awareness. Now, with concentration, you contract and focus. And while you're sitting, that concentration can become so strong that it stops any hindrance from arising. How can you observe what a hindrance does to you when that happens? You can't. And then as soon as you get up off the pillow and start moving around, your concentration is gone. What do you get attacked by? Do you know how to handle that? Have you learned through your meditation what to do with these hindrances in your daily life? When you practice one-pointed concentration, you haven't. When you practice this opening and allowing everything to be, your mind doesn't go so deep into concentration that it suppresses anything. It's opening and allowing and observing. Now, restlessness is like an automobile. An automobile is a concept. When you start looking for an automobile, where is it? Is it the headlights? Is it the bumper? Is it the motor? Is it the wheels? Is it the steering wheel? Where is the automobile? It's a lot of little parts put together to make up this concept of automobile. Restlessness is the same. Sloth and torpor, liking, disliking, all of that. Doubts, any hindrance. They're all the same. How does it work? Not why. That's psychology. We don't care about why. That's endless. You can look for answers and go all the way back in your past regression and your past lifetimes and all of this kind of stuff to find out answers of why you're experiencing what you are right now, but that doesn't really purify your mind. The only thing that purifies your mind is seeing how the process works. Now, when I say how the process works, already we've taken it from being personally, this is my restlessness, to, oh, it's a feeling, and then it's a tightness, and then the feeling's bigger, and then there's a thought, and then there's more feeling, and bigger and bigger, and you see how it all really works. I'm not going to tell you how it works all exactly. You have to tell me. I can't give away all the secrets. So when there's a lack of mindfulness, there's always an emotional reaction that occurs. Why is it a reaction? Because you act in the same way every time that emotion comes up. It's not exactly the same words, but the feeling is always the same, and the dislike is always the same, and the attachment to it is always the same. And the lack of clarity is always the same. But when the mindfulness is good, you stop looking at it as a personal thing and start seeing it as part of a process. Then you've already started to let go of the attachment. Now, a real interesting thing. Last summer, I ran across a magazine. It's What is Enlightenment? It's one of these New Age magazines. And they had a question about what is ego? And they ask Hindus, and they ask Tibetan monks, and they ask Vipassana teachers, and they ask a whole bunch of different people in this magazine, what is ego? Oh, ego is something bad, and you have to push it down. We don't want ego. And they haven't got a clue how it manifests. What is not the question? How? That's the question. How does it arise? It always arises as tightness in your mind and in your body. Always. Every time you let go of that tightness, there's a clear spot. There's no tension. There's pure awareness. And when you take that mind and come back to your object of meditation, you're able to see with better clarity. Every time you do that, you become a little clearer. And the more clear you become, the deeper in the meditation you get. And it doesn't take that long. It doesn't. Yeah. And if you get rid of mind, you live. You really live. You're in the present moment. You haven't got all of these disturbing things coming up and attacking you. Last February, I did a 2-week retreat, and it was a great retreat. I was walking around for long periods of time without having any thoughts of the future or the past. I was completely in the present moment. And I was walking around, I did it with another student, and I kept on saying, there's so much relief. I mean, this is the deep happiness that the Buddha is talking about. The relief of not rehashing something or being worried about what's going to happen. And there were still thoughts. I had to get up and go to the bathroom. There was the thought that I had to go to the bathroom. I knew it. As soon as I knew it, there was no more thoughts. I went and did it. But this doesn't mean that you completely blank your mind. If you blank your mind, you're a zombie. And that's not meditation. And that's not the goal of meditation. The goal of meditation is to be clear without any tightness or tension arising anywhere in your mind or body. And it is attainable. Not just a little bit. A lot. Now, when you have unguarded sense doors and you don't have any restraint in eating, that leads directly to the ego identification with whatever arises in the sense door. Okay, in the Middle Link Sayings in Sutta number 53, and it says, and how does the noble disciple guard the doors of his sense faculties? On seeing a form with the eye, the noble disciple does not grasp at its signs and features. What does that mean? when the eye hits the color and form, that eye consciousness arises. There's no grasping and holding on to this and saying, this is me, this is mine. There's only the seeing while they're seeing. So you don't grasp on to the form or the color and the niceness of it or the ugliness of it. There's just the seeing and allowing it to be there by itself. Now when you do this, your mind becomes much more clear. And one of the big things, now the reason that these two things are together is guard the sense doors, but food is one of the real distractions in our life. And people, they live to eat. A Buddhist monk eats to live. That's the way we do it. But I've seen immeasurable pain come to people because they're led around by their tongue, or they're led around by their nose. And they get an idea, I want some cheesecake. And the only place there's cheesecake is 5 miles away. So what do? They get in the car and they have all this energy and effort to get to this piece of cheesecake that they know is going to be outstanding and that never is as good as they thought it would be. Right? Now what just happened there? Their nose picked them up off the ground, put them in the car and drove it all the way over to where they could get this thing. Or their tongue. Whatever. Yeah, try closing your eyes and eating sometime. Restraint in food is a real interesting thing. The Buddha said that you eat the food. And the way that he ate was he would put rice in his mouth and he would chew it until there was no more solid pieces of rice. And then he would swallow. Wait until it turns to liquid. So many people now, when they start eating, they gobble. And you chew 2 or 3 times and swallow. And that's hard on your body. For one thing, the less you chew, the less saliva is mixed with the food, and that's the first part of digestion. And when you eat this way, you don't eat as much. You feel more satisfied. And the Buddha said that you eat until your stomach is half full. And then you take a quarter of that for water and a quarter for air. One of the real advantages of eating raw food is you can't eat it fast. Your jaw muscles, if you're not used to it, get tired because you're chewing so much. But a lot of people become very healthy because they start eating these kind of things. Quite interesting. So when you have an idea about a certain kind of food, wouldn't it be nice if I had that? And then you see it and your mind becomes excited. What does your mind feel like at that time? A rock. Literally, heavy. But because there's excitement, you don't notice it. And where's the mindfulness then? A lot of times people will ask me, "What do you want to eat?" I don't know. What do you got? Anything, fine. I don't care. I just have to get something in the stomach to keep the body feeling good, keep the body healthy. Now, during the time of the Buddha, there were monks that they would be kind of disgusting, and what they would do is they would go out on alms round and they get a huge amount of food. Now, I've gone on out on alms round in Bangkok, and I literally came back with two shopping bags and my bowl full of food. Now, this is enough for 10 or 12 people, but these monks would get this much food, and they got a high from eating the food, so they'd get real full, and then they'd throw it up, and then they'd eat some more, and then they'd throw it up like that. That's against the rules, because the Buddha found out about it. They were grasping at the taste, and they wanted to continue that going. Now, if you take a flower, like one of these gardenias, it's incredibly beautiful to smell. And you pluck it, and you smell it, and you smell it, and you smell it, and then you start noticing it doesn't have any odor anymore. You've taken all that smell away. Try it. But that is if you get into it and do that every time you get around gardenias, you're really attached to your nose. Now, there's nothing wrong with smelling a flower and appreciating it and then going on. You're not grasping at it that way. You're appreciating it and continue. So the way you guard your sense doors is by seeing that mind that grabs onto it, and then let it go. When your mindfulness gets good with all of the sense doors, you see it start to do that, and you know that it's going to be painful, so you open up and let it go. Now, the sense doors, there's six of them. Eyes, ears, nose, tongue, body, mind. That's the one that catches almost everybody all the time, because they get real involved in thoughts. They get real involved in the liking and disliking of thoughts. Yeah. Because it is. It senses thoughts, doesn't it? Would you know you had any thoughts if you didn't have mind? Okay, now this book is truly one of the most fantastic books I've ever run across. It's called Power versus Force. And what they're doing is studying what consciousness is. Okay? Now I want to read a couple of different things here. One of the things it says is, like love, laughter heals because it arises from viewing a small context from a larger and more inclusive one. Now, how many times have you heard me the last time I was here that you have to laugh at yourself and laugh into things? Why do I say that? If you see you have anger and you laugh at yourself for being angry, are you angry anymore? No, there's anger. It's not mine, it's only anger. Big deal. That's how powerful laughter is. Your sense of humor is absolutely necessary for the spiritual path. And that's something a lot of people forget. They get so serious about the meditation that they forget that they're supposed to be happy and have a uplifted life. And meditation is one thing and life is something else. They have that division. But what I'm trying to show you is meditation is all the time. It's not just about sitting and being a statue. It's about being aware of all of these different things when they arise and how your mind causes you pain by the grasping, the liking, disliking mind, and all of the thoughts about it, and the habitual thinking and acting. Every joke reminds us that our reality is transcendent beyond the specifics of events. One of the frequent accompaniments of sudden enlightening realizations is laughter. Isn't it? The cosmic joke is the side-by-side comparison of illusion with reality. Illusion as a sense door? No, that's just part of mind. That's the ignorance. I wouldn't. Not at all. I tried it for a while and it just, no. And that's like you're trying to enlighten mind with mind instead of getting to the consciousness and seeing how it works. Yeah, he and Nisargadatta, he had a book called I Am That. Yeah, and that is the Hindu thing that the Buddha, he pretty much rejected. He pretty much said, no, it's deeper than this. And the reason that the Buddha rejected it was you come to these conclusions through one-pointed concentration, without seeing that subtle tightness that arises with all of these things. Mind is one of the sense doors. It arises in mind. But we want the consciousness. I'll talk about consciousness in just a minute. Okay. Humorlessness, in contrast, is the is inimical to health and happiness. Totalitarian systems are notably deprived of humor at any level. Laughter brings acceptance and freedom. Heavy duty, huh? Now we're going to talk a little bit about consciousness here. Great leaps in level of consciousness are always preceded by surrender of the illusion that I know. I'll read that again. Great leaps in level of consciousness are always preceded by surrender of the illusion that I know. That gets in the way of everybody. Frequently, the only way one can reach this willingness to change is when one hits bottom, by running out a course of action to its end and in the defeat of a futile belief system. Light cannot enter a closed box. The upside of catastrophe can be an opening to a higher level of awareness. And this is what happened to me when I spent 2 years doing a very, very intensive Vipassana retreat in Burma. And they told me that the experience I had was it. And I knew in my heart it wasn't. and I tested it, and it wasn't. I hit rock bottom. And that made me start looking for, what did the Buddha really talk about? And that's when I started going to the suttas and trying to discern what the suttas were telling us and seeing the mistakes that they were talking about with the Vipassana. This is exactly what my experience is. If life is viewed as a teacher, then it becomes just that. Unless the painful lessons of life which we deal ourselves are thus transformed through humility into gateways of growth and development, they are wasted. We witness, we observe, we record.